I guess I was probably about 18 years old or so when I had watched a person garden. But it was primarily raised as a fisherman. And my grandfather had adopted three sons. And they were his stepsons, actually, because he married this woman who had three sons already, and raised them from when they were small, indoctrinated as children, took them through the water, cold water during the winter months in Chilkoot, and he raised them as his own. Though they maintained their only one of them ended up with his last name, Jeff David. But the other ones were Ted Lawrence and John Lawrence. And Ted was a type of person that was pretty well learned. He understood quite a bit about television and radio. He was very meticulous with his hands. And he also worked in outboards. And he was the type of individual that liked hunting and liked fishing. Although he was handicapped, he had one lung from tuberculosis. And also he was amputated from the ankle down, or from the shin down, and on one leg. And he really enjoyed seal hunting, or things that he could be able to do, rabbit hunting, he liked trout fishing. He just enjoyed all those type of things. But during the winter months, he did some real super fine carving miniature poles. Some of them were fairly good size. I would say probably about at least 3 feet. And that served as an inspiration to me, but you know, I didn't take it really all that serious. And he cut off small sections of the cedar that he was using to have me kind of putter around with and tinker with. Yeah, I did some. And then after a while, I went into the service. And never mind doing all that kind of stuff. I was a paratrooper. And I got back fairly young and didn't know what I was going to do with myself. I wanted to get out just in time for fishing, which I did. But one year I ended up working in a sawmill after service. And you know, rather than fish, I thought I'd try something different. But it got to the point where fishing in 1962 was coming about in May. And so I ended up working on somebody's boat, underneath the boat, preparing for fishing season. And I ended up in a hospital because they thought I had tuberculosis from the sawdust jellyfish powder and the copper paint that I was inhaling or breathing. And I started coughing up blood, so they sent me to the hospital thinking I had tuberculosis, and it wasn't really tuberculosis, I caught pneumonia as well. And so the hospital, there wasn't anything to do in there, so through occupational therapy ended up thinking about some of the things that Ted Lawrence got me involved in. So I filled up the showcase full of miniature poles.
The showcase at the hospital?
At the hospital. And I also took up some painting or drawing. I drew a picture of an old girlfriend I had on in a small photograph in black and white. And pretty interesting close likeness of the old girlfriend. I did another one, only on pulp paper. And so I thought that wasn't good enough, so I added a little bit of paint. And got really inspired by the whole business of discovering that what I could be able to accomplish at that hospital. Well, I got out after 55 days. They told me I really didn't need to be there anymore. And fishing season by that time was about over with. It was hard to get on with somebody else. I was instructing, also just teaching a little bit in dancing with Carl Heinmiller's group. And Alaska Indian Arts Incorporated. And so they decided to go down to, I guess it was around 62. They were going down for a traveler's convention. And with this traveler's convention, they had some fellows at the party that were already in Santa Fe, New Mexico, going to an Indian art school down there to come north up to Las Vegas for this put on a performance. And so in the meantime, I guess Carl had decided, since he dropped the guys out from school, it would be best to take them back, everybody go back to Santa Fe to put on a performance there. So when we all went back, I was accepted at that school. So I took, and I showed him some of my work that I had with me. Carl asked me to do that, and so I did. So in the meantime, I had since I was an exception to that school, there were several other people that were my age too, I didn't realize. But it was an opportunity for me, and I only had about a couple of years taking art and maintain other interests other than carving. And I took silk screening, block printing, that type of thing, which was minor. And so when they...
The nephew.
Why is that?
That's the way it is.
Whether or not that nephew is a carver?
Yeah, but the, let me explain the traditional aspect. Usually the uncle is the one that raises the nephew from your mother's side, on your mother's side. They end up with the same crest.
So your Uncle Ted, that was the you were following along traditional lines then?
He was from the other.
He's from your father's side?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't really an uncle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. He was an adopted uncle.
He was adopted. I'll be right back.
We were talking about traditionally the nephew inherited from the uncle.
And they usually follow the line on the mother's side, the clan side. I was raised by my grandfather. Or it could be traditional uncle. He's the one that does the indoctrination and also the teaching. But there wasn't really that much time. And a lot of the ways that they did things seems to me that were kind of the hard way of doing things. But that's just the way they were. And, but this was up in Haines, not down here in Ketchikan. And, I guess the whole reasoning behind that was so that you wouldn't be, spoiled by your father. Or your real parents.
Huh.
And that means that tradition isn't really practiced that much anymore. So that's just something from way back, the way they used to do things.
Well, you were saying that you ended up going to school in Santa Fe.
Well,
that's a lot.
The school in Santa Fe was a little bit more contemporary oriented. In other words, since it was a conglomeration of various different types of art styles involved there.
Native art styles?
Native art styles. To kind of draw some of the traditional styles, those that were used to the traditional style to be able to apply some of the newer methods, which is really good, actually. And those that have gone through that particular school have come out, even from Alaska, that I know of, have maintained or continued or made art a lifestyle. And
they're more contemporary native artists as opposed to...
They're more contemporary native artists, but you find that since they've been brought from the traditional styling, a lot of it is being able to keep that in the back of their minds as well, and approach it from that view. But still being able to... I guess experiment with something that's a little different. And you find that a lot of the artists that came from there usually end up doing that. I tried to maintain a little bit more of a traditional flair.
But you're not strictly a traditionalist?
No, not really, since I've come from that school. When I went to New York in 64 to work at the World's Fair, I did some rather unusual paintings, experimentations, and doing something that probably wouldn't be fitting if one was to see those type of paintings again. It's just a kind of an experimentation.
When did you decide to become a carver, a full-time carver, or when did you decide that that was your calling?
I don't know. I'd say probably around 71, around about that time, because there have been times when I kind of floundered around a little bit. I did this, and I had a shop in 67 called the Ravenswing Art Studio. After quitting work with Heinmiller, their funding kind of dwindled a little bit, and so that kind of put me off to something else. And so I had a little shop, tried to do novelty type things, print t-shirts and print little stuff, and I didn't really get too excited about it. And I wasn't really making that much money either. And so it was mostly catering to the tourist, I felt. And really, you know, I wasn't really making a whole lot of money. And I did a few little odd things like painting. Of course, then I had a little bit more freedom. And I did some portraits. I stuck with that because I was always making, like it would take me about a 3-hour period to do a painting, or really buckle down and get it all done. And I'd sell them for at least somewhere around $50. So that's really, you know, making a good wage. Sold it, and started that doing longshoring. I wasn't really all that happy with it because the winter is really severe in Haines, as far as you know, as much as long, you know, doing the longshoring business. So I floundered around a little bit, and under the recommendation of Bill Holm, I had opportunities of going to, in 71, had an opportunity of going to Hazelton, British Columbia, and to instruct in dancing, and to draw some of the people to learn their traditional dances and stuff, mostly talking to some of the older people. There was a person there who was in charge of that whole operation, at Kazan, named Polly Sargent. And through that I met a fellow by the name of Dwayne Pasco, who was doing some large carving. He was doing a totem pole at, during the daytime, and at night he'd do masks and smaller items. And so it was kind of a workshop setting in which, like you see here today. And so I continued my little dances. In the meantime, I did a frontlet for my uncle, because Austin Hammond, who is a clan leader, and I did him a frontlet or a headdress. Yeah, because they were pretty much against me going, or somebody else was against me going, and a lot of it would reflect upon him for allowing me to go to Hazelton. And but I went, despite the problem at that time. And I had a pretty good time. It was nice.
So the first thing that you, or not the first thing, but you carved that frontlet.
Frontlet, and yeah. And then I also did a headdress. And then there was also another thing that was happening. A person by the name of Jane Demert, who is now, who at that time was the director of the Alaska State Museum, worked up a opportunity to have a show with a person by the name of Tony Hunt, who is a Kwakiutl Indian, and we have different styles all together. And so we had a show in December at about 71, and I sold everything that I made.
What did you have in the show?
I had several things like rattles. I had bedwood boxes.
So you spent, after this workshop that you went to, then you really started carving?
I really started carving, yeah. And I had hoped for opportunities of doing much bigger projects, and that didn't come around until a little bit later.
So when you started carving after this workshop, were you working on your own, or did you actually have a mentor that you...
I was working pretty much on my own. I wasn't working, you know, for somebody, but I came down here in 73. Well, actually, I was here in 71. I also instructed here for a little bit, and I think about 72 I was working with the Alaska State Museum and also the Department of Natural Resources, which was in charge of a project out of Totem Bight. And I was, I don't know if you'd call me a head carver, but I was the lead person there working on that project.
So you really, you came a long way in a very short period of time in terms of carving.
Yeah, one would consider it a very short amount of time, but you know, I'm a late starter, really, and I think that you know, if I really started out earlier and had the opportunity of being able to work under people like Bill Holm, I think I probably would have come along much further.
So you mentioned before that Bill Holm, you mentioned something about him, but I didn't understand where you had met him.
Yeah, I met him through Alaska Indian Arts. I was an instructor, by the way, up there. I was doing silk screening.
Uh-oh.
In 75.
Huh.
74 and 75, so... I'll be right out.
Okay.
Probably around 65.
65?
Yeah, I think it's around there. Because he came up to do the class as well, or be involved in a class when he had free time. And, he was already the instructor at the university in Washington.
Okay, and he came to do a class at the in Santa Fe?
No, not in Santa Fe, in Haines.
In Haines, okay.
And they had, the program that they had up there was called Manpower Development Training, MDTA. And through that, they had several different artists involved in this one project to try to encourage the arts. And they had some people come in from different places in the villages that were interested, either interested or didn't have anything else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And those folks. And there were some that ended up, you know, still making a living on their own as artists, either working in jewelry or whatever. And they had one instructor by the name of Lincoln Wallace, who had rheumatoid arthritis really bad, who was instructing in engraving. And, you're just really... Several different shows that were occurring on Native Arts, and there were prizes, and this was maybe around 71 or so. In that time, I decided to enter several different things that I felt that were, they were okay, you know, they would do pretty well. And there were money prizes. And one year, a person by the name of Leo Jacobs won a whole bunch of prizes. And I thought, well, I guess I'm just going to have to go for it this year. So I did. And I won a whole bunch of prizes.
Huh. What did you carve?
Oh, I carved masks. I won in the mask category. I had one in the block printing category. Yeah, I did. I tried to cover all bases. I did jewelry. So I just went hog wild on this whole thing. And then afterwards, I had that show. And of course, that show in 71 in December. I managed to get quite a few orders, and by then I knew that I could be able to make a living at being an artist if I wanted to. And so from then on, there were a lot of different trial and error type of things. Trying to look at thought of the items that were in the museum. Books were another thing. Of course, you know, having Bill's main textbook on analysis and form. Each time a new book would come out, I'd see if I could find stuff. Well, one of the things that I feel about a lot of the understanding of Northwest Coast art probably wouldn't happen too much if, you know, if I had to do a lot of research on my own, because I had an idea of what I was looking at and looking for, but I really clearly didn't understand it. And so with Bill's explanation through photograph and coming up with terms, kind of was pretty enlightening.
So you really learned a lot from his book then about...
Well, yeah. From his book, from a lot of see, one of the major gripes that I have is that there are a lot of items in the various different museums. A lot of the people don't really get that much from the East Coast.
Oh, because it's too far away.
It's too far away. We don't get a chance to feel any of those items or see them or examine them. And all the items that we see, you know, we can probably copy. And that's one thing about being an artist is just being able to copy, but to go... I'd say probably a reputation of finally gearing down to probably in the 80s, now that we're in the 90s. But I would say probably a commission for me was based on being able to draw a design or an idea, lay down an idea and try to get some sort of proportion and to submit that design and which won me a few, you know, commissions. And just trying to figure out prices was a difficult thing for me. It still is, because you really don't know how much time that you have involved in doing something. Actually, there have been projects where, you know, time, if a person was to gauge it according to the 8-hour work days that most people do, when you're working in carving, sometimes you have days where people ask you questions, want to come around and start talking and all those kind of things. You find that it kind of takes that much more time. You don't punch in and you don't punch out when you're talking to somebody, right? And so when you're working in the evening, you don't keep track of...
What's the first totem that you carved and where is it now?
Let me see. I probably here at the Heritage Center. At least a fairly big one. But I've had one I did one in Washington, D.C., and I also did one in Seattle. But both of these were probably recommendations that were by Bill Holm. I think, I might be wrong, but for some reason, I was doing a poll down in Seattle Sea Alaska, which was also a Alaskan promotional thing. It was organized by a guy named Larry Beck. You know Larry Beck? And he was the one who organized that promotional thing. And so I went down to Seattle, did a small little poll at Barn Marché. And what else? And then I stayed with my aunt, and they managed to track me down and asked me to do a project at in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize what it was going to be, a totem pole. I brought my chainsaw. I brought my adze. I didn't have a hatchet. And they had a log waiting for me. And I worked on a plane doing a bracelet on the plane. So I was engraving all night when I got over there. And I figured all I'd end up doing was making a mask or some little thing. This was a folk festival in Washington, D.C. with all the Indians, the different tribes. And so they had this log waiting for me. And so the lady that was coordinating the thing, Claudia Nowiski, looked at me and she says, "Well, we have a log here. But first, I think you better get some sleep."
Did you finish the totem there? Did you actually do it?
Yeah, I did it in 7 days. It was a 7-footer.
Wow.
I was really moving.
I guess so.
Well,
what did you do? What was the design?
Oh, it was a raven. I think it was a raven and a whale or something like that.
What is your clan? What is that?
I'm a raven.
So do you, most of your poles?
No, not really. No.
Is the one that you, the first one that you did, is it, which this big one?
Yeah, that was kind of the major one.
This was your first one?
Well,
is that a raven pole?
Well, I was in charge of this one and involved in doing one out of totem bite, but that wasn't really anything, you know, that was kind of my own thing. So.
I remember whose apprenticeship it was, but they said that during the apprenticeship there were a lot of songs and stories and things like that, so I wondered if you know, if that was just kind of a way for you guys to pass the time, or if that was something that you thought was important to, you know, some knowledge or a traditional way of working that you were, you know, that was important for them to learn.
Well, I think it all depends on, you know, what provoked the person more. So far that I know, that I haven't really gotten into too many songs and those type of things, you know, as far as while we're working, because I generally try to focus into, you know, getting some sort of discipline, and it's really hard for me because I'm not disciplined at all, you know.
Well, what do you try to teach when you're teaching an apprentice? Do you let them ask what they want to know, or do you try to...
No, one of the things that I feel that is pretty important is learning a lot of safety factors and learning also to handle and make tools. And I'm not really proficient at that, but I kind of feel that it's good for a person to have their own tools. And I can't say that I really know, you know, every little tittle about a blacksmith would know about metal. But what I do know is fairly basic, and so that's what I teach generally. And a good share of the time, any person who's working today can be able to buy any of their own tools, you know, which I encourage rather than, you know, end up using somebody else's. And so we get into that, and in working big things, there are a lot of little questions that generally arises, and to provide the answers. And also, since I learned from watching, And that's only one way that a person can be able to learn, is by watching, experimenting by themselves. When Bill showed me the ants, I knew there were things that we weren't doing that was right in Haynes in coming up with a textual background. And Bill showed me, I asked him about it, and he demonstrated for me the ads. Then I knew that we were doing something that wasn't really right. And so with that, the ads plays a very important part of working, knowing how to handle it, and learning control, and also learning themselves, you know, how to get textual quality work, and those type of things are pretty important.
Yeah, I was what, and I know we talked a little bit about this yesterday. You said when you were growing up, you you know, you observed your uncle carving, and that's where, you know, your interest was piqued, I guess, at least through that, or you know, not your real uncle, but your grandfather's stepson. That was the, and so I guess, you know, one of the things I haven't quite understood yet, at least, is where, you know, was your knowledge of traditional carving and forms and style and the right way to do things, did that come just from your own observation, or did somebody actually, you know, an older person, did they actually teach you or show you the way that these were supposed to be done?
In thinking back, there are very few people that had, you know, taught the real old way as far as teaching goes. As I mentioned before, that the nephew was the one that picked up from the uncle. And I suppose that it probably happened along the same lines as far as the traits were concerned, that they knew that the individual would probably have the ability to be able to carve or do artwork if they really, you know, were interested and seriously pursued it. But I know that I know very few. I don't believe I know of any in the art areas. I know that as far as the language, there have been those that have picked up the language as a child and were raised and brought up by their practically grandfathers, you know, that raised their child. And
but where did, you know, did, was there somebody who taught you specifically? I remember one of the things one of the Beasley boys said yesterday was when they were studying with you, you taught them the Clinkett design. I mean, you said, like, the arch of the eyebrow, how Clinkett is supposed to do it. I mean, that's what I learned from Nathan. And I thought, well, how did you learn what was the Clinkett way to do an eyebrow? I mean, as opposed to a Hyde or a Chin. Who taught you that?
I don't know. I think one of the things that happens is an artist usually is pretty critical. I guess just by seeing. And, you know, I picked up quite a bit as far as, you know, just trying to copy that portrait, for instance. Um,
when you try to add color to something that you're copying that is from black and white, mm-hmm. and try to get some sort of steps, you kind of look at yourself in a mirror. I look at myself in a mirror and try to cast a few shadows and try to figure out where I was going, what I was doing there. And so it's just, in that way, it was experimental, or something that you recollect, that you've seen, as something that catches your eye. There are books that have good illustrations that way. So that to me, the only way that you can be able to, pick up on something.
Just the books?
Through books, maintaining that. But in my association with Bill, there have been times when I have accumulated a lot of slides through him, and he has accumulated slides. And also Steve here, Steve Brown, who has, had a lot of influence in that way. I would say probably fairly recently. And
would you say these guys have influenced your work at all?
Pardon?
Would you say that Steve and Bill have influenced your work?
I should imagine they have, yeah. I know that the time that I had inquired, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but I had inquired about Anzing and really looked at the way we were doing it, which was with a gouge to get a textural effect. And I had a kind of feeling that we were not going about it the right way. And I asked Bill to give a little bit of demonstration. Remember that, Bill?
What's that?
To give a demonstration in the Anzing.
When was that?
That was up in Haines.
Oh, yeah?
When, I think it was 65. 64. About that time. And so he gave a little demonstration. And ever since then, just looking at the blade and just kind of examining it a little bit. And then looking at some of the ones that were from the museum, I had association with the museum a little bit with James Demmer and Peter Corey. And I didn't mention Peter earlier, but Peter Corey had been the curator of the, curator of collections, and Riemann Ellis was curator of exhibit. So, anyways, with these people, I was able to look at some of the items at the museum. They were quite helpful. And I think one thing is I didn't have a camera, so a lot of it is trying to remember a lot of things that you see. So that's the only way. When Edward Kiton was the curator of the museum, when they had it in Juneau at the Capitol building, the only thing that I could do was just walk through and just look at some of the items that were there through a showcase and maybe try to sketch something. And I guess the thing that my grandfather had shown me too is whenever, like like mending net or hanging net, he usually shows you one time and expects you to catch it. And if you didn't catch it, then, you know, he'd just take it away from you and start south. And so sometimes you have to do this by yourself, you know. I mean, it's like language. Sometimes I had struggled with language because of not being able to get the words right. And oftentimes they'd laugh at me. And I wouldn't, my the Tlingit structure or sentence structure is kind of backwards, so it isn't what you're really accustomed to when you're speaking English. I really had difficulty with that. And in translation, and sometimes they'd laugh at me. So I'd go back and I'd speak to myself away somewhere.
Well, do you consider yourself a master artist?
I think a master artist is somebody that one would probably consider far out doing and having a lot of apprentices, being able to teach a whole group like Mr. Holmes does, or Steve. I think it's knowledge passed on and shared if anybody inquires about it. I think it's a title that has been thrown around fairly loosely, and I don't know. Before, I didn't want to accept that title, and just the way I feel. But at any point, when a person puts in an application, they have to put in an application for a master artist.
Yeah.
And so that's the way it goes. So,
yeah. But how do you
what else could you?
How do you feel about that yourself, though?
Well, I don't think there's any other title that the person can use if they're putting in for that grant.
Mm. Do you think of something like being called just a teacher is?
I think that's plenty good enough. I don't have no problem with that.
Yeah, so that's a title that was kind of given to fit the application.
Yeah. And usually, whenever you know we're working in Saxman, I wouldn't mind being called a head carver or something, or a lead carver or something like that. I guess that would be probably in the foreman category.
Mm-hmm.
But what else can you call somebody?
Well, I think I've got just about everything I need, unless you want to add something of your own about, you know, about the artwork or the tradition, or anything you might want to say about it.
Well, I suppose right at this, you know, the people here that are working in the rattles, mm-hmm. seems like a fairly small subject, delicate. It seems to me like all the people that are available here are really enjoying this type of setting. Whereas in the olden days, I don't suppose that there was
kind of this type of setting at all. You know. And there had been mention of a revival or rekindling or an interest to people getting reinterested in the art form. And I suppose that, you know, for the native person who has some sort of ability, you know, what else can he do with it if he discovers that he has some sort of ability? And I kind of feel like they've got to be channeled in the right way, and they've got to be encouraged in the art form. And not everybody's going to be doing the same thing. Not everybody's going to be doing rattle. Some may want to do jewelry. And some may want to pick doing drums. Some may want to do paddles and like to stick to frontlets and those type of things in order to start in the art field. As I've mentioned before, Bill had enlightened me as far as the two-dimensional art form is concerned, and
had enlightened you in what way?
Well, I guess when I did a block print of a bentwood box in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I knew that they all joined together. I knew that the forms, yeah, I knew they all joined together. I tried to do that. But as far as the width of the line broadening and narrowing off and those type of things, and being very consistent and related to each other, I guess when I think back on some of that stuff, I'm glad that they weren't something that was exposed as being some of my work, you know, because you have an idea, but you're not too sure. And I wasn't really all that sure at that time. And even now, there are a lot of things that I'm really not too sure. So, with that, it's pretty hard to say, you know, and be called a master artist. And I guess the way I look at it, and especially after coming back from Italy, to see stuff that was done by, you know, Michelangelo, and to see all the fine craftsmanship that was being done then, and they actually knew what they were doing, whereas here we're kind of trying to figure out what we're doing, whether, you know, to see whether or not we're doing the right thing, and even to satisfy at times, be, you know, with what we're doing, with what we've done.
Mm-hmm. Well, the things that you say that you're not too sure about, do you know where to go to find out about them? You said there, even now, there are some things you're not too sure about. Do you know where you can go to find out?
For information, as far as reference, I mentioned Bill again, and Bill and Steve, those that have really interest in good craftsmanship and things that they desire to, like Steve is really interested in canoes. He taught the class not too long ago here, and I participated, and I really didn't know anything about, you know, canoes, not that much, and if I did a big one, I don't think that I'd be you know, I probably wouldn't be satisfied, and I'd be up against the wall. and critical, mm-hmm. self-critical, or knowing somebody that is, you know, would, if they gave me a critique, they'd probably say, well, I'm, this part right here, I probably would have handled different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you're, you know that you really didn't know what you were doing when you approached the project. Mm-hmm. I like to feel comfortable about that, mm-hmm. you know, having an idea of what I'm doing. Any more, even those types of subjects. It's difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get thinking when you're doing something, whether you're making money or not, and you have to make a living at being an artist. You're not a fisherman anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of think, well, what am I doing here, or is there something else that I could be doing?
Mm-hmm.
Really, when I think about it, there's very many other things I'd want to do.
Mm-hmm. That's great.